National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. How does a city develop a brand, and why is branding of cities done so badly so often? That's a question we asked Paul O'Connor, who has an enviable record of branding Chicago for the world market. He is founding executive director of World Business Chicago, and he'll tell us about his branding experience and how to avoid the common mistakes today on Smart City. And since the ability to brand a city depends on the reality the city delivers, we'll also talk with Jeff Perlman, mayor of Delray Beach, Florida, who has led the revitalization of that city. The branding of cities is our subject today on Smart City. We'll talk with guest Paul O'Connor and Mayor Jeff Perlman right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. As the founding executive director of World Business Chicago, Paul O'Connor came to the startup Public-Private Economic Development Corporation after a career spanning journalism, state government, and corporate marketing. He was Mike Royko's leg man at the Chicago Daily News, helped John Calloway launch his nightly news show on Chicago Public Television, and was a newspaper columnist at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Paul served as press secretary to the governor of Washington, as Illinois' second-ranking public health official, and then as the deputy director for marketing of the Illinois Department of Commerce and Community Affairs. You are a fourth-generation Chicagoan, and you've been a close observer of the city for many years, first as a journalist and now as head of World Business Chicago. Paul, why is Chicago not Detroit or Cleveland?
I think it's for a lot of reasons. Part of the reason is because of the downtown core was preserved, which has not been the case for most American cities. And I think that the reason for that is Chicago has a history of radical change. It changes with the economy and has done so since its earliest days. So I think it's remained a dynamic city. I think in the current era, really you have to give credit to Mayor Richard M. Daley and all that he's done since 1989 that really has transformed the place. Anyone who grew up here almost wouldn't recognize it had they moved away.
So you think it's a combination both of the structural and also the leadership?
I think so. I think that there are elements of scale as well that are very helpful. The other thing that Chicago has going for it is a extraordinarily diversified economy, so that it has been able to respond to economic downturns and maintain a good, solid quality of life throughout the whole process. So it's remained a healthy place and has adapted to economic change. Really, since the 80s, you've seen a dramatic change from a hugely dependent manufacturing city into one that's really driven by the professional services, and that's been the latest wave that has come through. And the professional services are really those skill sets that are driving the global economy, really the knowledge workers and the knowledge thinkers. And that the big change has been that by working on the quality of life of the city, making it safe and clean and attractive, a place where Gen X and Gen Y want to be, then what has happened is that the city has become a magnet for the cutting-edge talent that you really need to drive competitive companies and competitive companies that are operating globally. And so now for the first time, what we're starting to see is the movement of companies that fled the city, maybe in the 70s, coming back downtown to access that talent pool.
Your organization led the successful effort to land the world headquarters of Boeing for Chicago, and you talk to business prospects all the time. Are there common threads, Paul, that run through all these conversations you have that reflect what businesses want in a city today?
Yes. I think that there are a couple of key issues. The first and foremost is the access to the quality talent. That keeps coming on stronger and stronger, and no matter whether it's a small company or a huge company, the access to talent is critical. Second piece is the quality of life, which serves as the magnet to attract and hold that talent. as well as the amenities that are kind of appurtenances to business, hotels, great restaurants, those kind of things. And the third piece are really the fundamental infrastructures of modern business. Chicago's a town that's really used infrastructure, originally rail and water, now air, and also now digital infrastructure to make money and connect itself to the world. So businesses really want the air connection from which they can work North America and from which they can work the world. So increasingly, the airport has become much more powerful, our two airports, and the workforce is the king, and it's getting stronger and stronger as the driving force.
I want to talk to you about an effort to brand Chicago you started about 3 years ago. Tell me, how did you approach the question of how to brand Chicago?
Well, we've done it lots of ways. We began by having conversations with consul generals and with others in Chicago because we had a very strong sense that the new Chicago was just not well known out there. So we did an initial effort to identify Chicago as a product and did some qualitative anthropological work to get some sense from the international business community of how they saw Chicago. And then we produced a kind of a set, a brand positioning and a general view of things. Then later on, we went to another effort, which was by getting together pro bono with the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, which many consider the best marketing school on earth. And over the course of about a year, we worked with 17 graduate students to both characterize Chicago as it is, to do a huge sample of one-on-one interviews with business leaders here and around the world, and then to do the analysis of where we set as a competitive set, I mean, among the other cities that, with whom we compete. And then we again came to a position that was the underlying positioning for a brand. But what? We did it very much as we've got this great product. People in the marketplace are not aware of it. And so we need to do the branding to get us there.
What did the research tell you, Paul, about Chicago's perceived strengths and weaknesses?
Well, the strengths were things that we knew. And the interesting part is that you tend to, throughout the whole process, validate what your guts sort of tell you in the beginning. So the more complicated and the brainier we got, the more we heard back what we thought in the first place. But now we have proof of it. So it really said that you have strengths of location and the diversity of the population and the skill set of the workforce, the strengths of the infrastructure and the quality of life, that those were all very strong things. But on the other side, there were very strong perceptions that somehow it's nuclear winter out here and it's the end of the world. And the other three seasons, nobody seemed to pay any attention to. And that there was really, we thought that there were lingering negative images of kind of a smokestack, industrial Al Capone kind of a town. And really what we found more was that there was more nothing there. One of the problems that Chicago faces with a diversified economy is that other cities have very clear niches. New York is media and finance. Seattle is software and airplanes. LA is entertainment and defense. But when you come to Chicago, it dominates maybe 10 or 12 different industrial sectors, and therefore our niche is no niche. And from a marketing point of view, we were just not on anybody's radar.
Anything else that surprised you?
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise was when we went, we probably did one of the largest samples ever done, really, of CEOs, and we had about 65 of those one-on-one for 45 minutes to an hour. And we drilled into them on what were the assets of doing business in Chicago. And we expected to hear workforce productivity, sort of Midwestern values, the infrastructure issues. And instead, they consistently came back to us with two things. And one was a very strong, which is quality of life. So the business people and the business leadership of the city and elsewhere were saying to us, quality of life is the real asset of the town. And then that evolved into this sort of second part of that, which is that it was a place that had a unique kind of culture. Its people were extraordinarily friendly and open and with their sort of distinctive sense of humor. But the big insight was that the value that top business leadership put on quality of life.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Paul O'Connor. He is Executive Director of World Business Chicago. You talk about quality of life as being the surprise asset of doing business in Chicago, according to the business decision makers that you interviewed. When they say quality of life is one of those sort of mushy things that hard to talk about, hard to pin down. If I like to ski, my quality of life, you know, mountains are really important to my quality of life, where if you like to go to the beach, then the beach is part of your quality of life. What were people really telling you? Did you drill down on it?
Yes, we'd actually had another effort that was done by the University of Illinois at Champaign, and that was another year-long effort that was geared really toward and focused on the technology workforce, because it's clear that the perception of a community by the younger tech workers, the creative thinkers, was really driven. It was a huge branding issue. And the issue we found there was that quality of life is great, but if you cannot at the same time offer resume building experience, then they will take a pass on the quality of life. So you get a situation, Austin, Texas, is driven hugely by the perception of its quality of life. When it became clear that you could have in Chicago a life like a city in the movies and pursue your career no matter what direction you want to go, as well as have the accompanying your accompanying partner or spouse be able to pursue her or his career in any direction they wanted to go, then all the pieces fell together. So quality of life without the career opportunities does not compute by itself. And so when you've got these 30 Fortune 500 companies and really an economy that is the most diversified in the United States and a labor force of like 4 million people, then you can go anywhere you want. So the two of those came together, and kids have come from all over the United States to Chicago, and it's really very much become a young, cool, hip town.
And one of the things we've found in some of the research we've done is that young people are congregating in fewer places. In fact, of the top 50 U.S. metros during the 90s, 15 of them gained 25 to 34-year-olds, and the rest of them lost 25 to 34-year-olds. Right. You mentioned the value of scale of Chicago earlier. If you were working, Paul, in a smaller community and you lose that value of, you lose that asset of scale, do you think it's a terrible disadvantage?
I do. And I think that you're going to see one of the fallouts of globalization. For instance, manufacturing gets a lot of attention, but you should look at Silicon Valley, what's happening to them. I think that you've got to remember that about half of the Fortune 500 are located in smaller communities of this country, and that they face a double problem. They both at the sort of the bottom end, the kids coming out of school, say in Iowa, has a great school system, but that the kids leave. And so often the governor of Iowa will come to Chicago and try to induce Iowans to go back home. The other part of the problem is that you've got at the top end of the scale companies that are Fortune 500 companies in Iowa that will go 10 months trying to fill a chief financial officer position. And then the third piece of the puzzle being the difficulty in physically accessing global markets. You drive to Des Moines, you get on an airplane, it takes you to O'Hare, you finally get on an airplane that takes you to Spain or Japan or wherever it is, and that gets pretty old. So I think that there really are concerns in that area, and I think that you will continue to see consolidation in some of the bigger cities, especially on the marketing communications and the consulting and other fields like that.
Mm-hmm. You were advised during this branding process to reframe Chicago's identity, expanding it from the capital of the Midwest to reflect a new global context. Do you think you've been successful in doing that?
I think that it's a process, and I think that's something that really is important to understand about the brand positioning, that it is not just a point of arrival that captures the product description that you're going to face to the outside world, hopefully to bring in more jobs and more business. The brand positioning really is kind of a dynamic engine, which can become a shared vision for a community that helps them get there, so that it helps you to migrate from what you, in the branding process, come to understand as your perception whether it's true or false. And then you have also your aspiration of what it is that you want to become as a city or a community. And so the brand positioning should serve as an engine that gets you there and a rallying point for bringing your own community together, because that's the heart and soul of it in any branding for any company or any enterprise at all. If the workers within the company don't believe it and live it and pursue the brand, then you're not going to get there. So I think the process has begun. Chicago is a global city, but because it's so big, its efforts are diversified and fragmented. And I think that they are starting to coalesce in a way that that is necessary to really keep up with the speed of change in the world now.
Well, you mentioned the fragmentation that inevitably exists in a big city like Chicago, with so many people having a piece of Chicago to promote, whether it's tourism, whether it's local business, I mean, minority business. I mean, you can think of a 100 different people who are, you know, who have their own version of Chicago. How have you attempted to coalesce those stories of Chicago and weave them into one story?
Well, we've taken the brand, all of our brand thinking, and given it away to anybody who will listen. And we also took it into a public relations positioning. And every quarter, we update the data that are the proof points of the claims that we make behind our brand Chicago and get them out to all the city entities, the city departments, to the mayor's speechwriter, to the Convention and Visitors Bureau, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing we do is our organization is public-private, not-profit, is chaired by Mayor Daley, but the rest of the board are very significant global companies. And so we have been visiting with the marketing communication people of each of those big companies to encourage them to find ways to take the branding and the branding insights to reflect both in their materials. For instance, on the Boeing put downtown skyline of Chicago on the cover of its annual report after moving here, or to weave concepts about Chicago into the speeches of the head of Motorola that's based in Chicago, those kind of things. So it's a general mobilization, and the idea is to try to resonate about central themes. Because one of the problems, as you were mentioning, was that when you get tourism going out in one direction and Convention and Tourism Bureau going out another direction, and us going in our own direction, and then the City Department of Planning going in another direction, and we're all kind of together, but we're really not. What can set up, and what usually sets up, is dissonance as opposed to resonance. The idea that everybody's saying something nice about Chicago does not necessarily contribute to sending a clear signal to the rest of the world, as opposed to sending mixed signals, which tend to cancel each other out or confuse each other.
Well, you make a good point. When you begin promoting a city's assets, the result is often a laundry list of attributes that don't add up to a compelling story. Give me, Paul, the short version of Chicago's story that resulted from the branding work you did.
The short story was that the audience was business decision makers of worldwide companies. That was the level of scale that we were operating at. And what was our benefit to them? The benefit that we offered them was business opportunity that was driven by a unique combination of abundant business resources, so the assets that you needed to do whatever your line of work was, but depth and a global class workforce, quality of life to hold and retain that workforce from the top to the bottom, and great people to build your enterprise with. And so those were really the three components. But for us, the central issue of the branding was the combination of them. I mean, New York's got huge, deep assets, but it's not a good place to live, I mean, compared to Chicago. You've got San Diego, which is a great place to live, but it doesn't have the assets that you need to run a global company unless you're in the biotech space. And then this huge asset of Chicago and its diversity, there is a movement in the United States, which is long overdue, but there's also a global movement to reach into the diversity of our population. And what Chicago has gone through, a long and difficult time throughout its history in the various racial, ethnic, religious groups sort of grinding on each other, but we've actually produced a Chicagoan, and a Chicagoan who is, we have Buddhist Cub fans and, people of every variety. Well, that turns into an enormous asset for global companies, and that's one of the big drivers was for Boeing, that had adopted a global diversity policy. So for them to be able to come to a marketplace in which Sunnis and Sikhs and Shias could all come and find their own grocery stores and their own places of worship, et cetera, and their own communities where they could speak and their own media where they could listen to the radio in their own language. These are hugely important driving factors in terms of building a global city. So the diversity of what was once the most segregated city in the world, the sociologists called it, is now, it turns out, to be one of our strongest assets.
Why are so many city branding efforts so bad?
I mean, my bottom line is I think they're looking for a tagline. And taglines are, in my opinion, death. They very rarely do the work, but people invest in them and they sound hokey and they're silly. And I think that the real flaw of city branding efforts is preaching to the choir. What we brought to the Boeing effort, as our organization brought to the Boeing effort, was the focus to the government and the rest of the economic development community that this is not about us. This is about Boeing, and this is about Boeing's executives, and it's about Boeing's strategic business plan and about Boeing's employees. And so the community that can speak to their needs and say, we have what it is that you need to get to where you want to go, that's the city that's going to win. So I think that the danger becomes it becomes a sort of more local politics, more of the same, that ends up with a sort of a cheesy, do-nothing, generic tagline. So my advice would be, don't use a tagline. Use your own city name as the tagline, unless something just profoundly resonant comes up.
How can you encourage a city to develop a global outlook?
I don't know, and I think my answer would be teach geography. Teach geography and language and try to keep explore the backgrounds of the people who are there and draw them out as assets and get some sense of where you are in the world. I think it's very difficult in America to do that. I mean, we're just so inwardly focused. My wife and I watch Canadian television every night so we can get some sense of like what America's doing in the world from somebody else's point of view. But I think you really've got to get on the bully pulpit from the political point of view. I think that the business leadership has got to talk about, what their environment is. And I think that there's been a lot of singing the blues and blaming, China, among others, for problems that the American economy faces. Well, Chicago's message to the world is, get over it, change, because the world changes, and if you don't change, then you'll be left behind. And so that's the fundamental issue, is to this is moving really fast. And the beauty is that if you look at China 20 years ago, it was really a backward place. And so the message is you can, whatever your community is, make the same kind of changes if you have that same community focus, and we're going to get there from here, because there probably every place has got real assets.
Paul O'Connor is Executive Director of World Business Chicago. Paul, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks, Carol. It's been a flattering experience.
After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the impact of big investments on city brands. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Jeff Perlman, mayor of Delray Beach, Florida, about the rejuvenation of his South Florida Village by the Sea. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, the dream of every mayor and every chamber of commerce head is that they will find the magic bullet, the one project that will change the fate of the city.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen very often. It actually used to happen more often than it does now. And I'll tell you the thing that you could look back on in history and see that these things did in fact change places were World's Fairs. The Columbian Exposition of 1893 in Chicago really elevated people's ideas about what a city could look like and the architecture of the city. They still in St. Louis talk about the World's Fair of 1904 that happened there. And, of course, the Eiffel Tower, which is probably the greatest symbol of any city anywhere in the world, was built for a World's Fair in 1889 and changed people's perspective about the city of Paris. But that's 100 years ago, and we pretty much think now that single projects, even big ones like World's Fairs, don't have the capability of really changing cities anymore. But there are a couple of examples in recent history which you could point to and say it had the kind of effect that a World's Fair did 100 years ago, in the sense that it suddenly got people who were thinking one way to think in another and far, far more positive way about a city. And the two examples are, the one from 1980 is Baltimore's building of the Harbor Place. That was it was a festival marketplace. It was probably the first that we recognize by that term, built in what's called the Inner Harbor area of Baltimore. And it fundamentally changed people's ideas about how exciting a downtown could be, because Baltimore was a pretty unexciting and drab place. And suddenly, thousands and thousands of people would come to visit this sort of dreary old industrial landscape because there was something exciting to do. And from that came just an incredible wave of development. And I would argue that the other one that you can point to that's very recent but could have that same impact on its city is the building of Millennium Park in Chicago, which I saw recently. And it is just simply an extraordinary place. It's an art park. It is unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It's not just green space. It's sculpture. It's playfulness. It's gardens. It is amphitheaters. It's just an extraordinary thing. And it's already beginning to reorient development in that part of Chicago, and it's almost certainly going to be followed by similar parks elsewhere in the country.
In fact, I think every city would like to have a Millennium Park, and it will be very interesting to watch the copycats.
Well, that's the great thing about cities is we're not afraid to steal good ideas from elsewhere, and that's to our benefit.
Otis, we'll keep looking for those silver bullets. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
You're listening to Smart City. Jeff Perlman covered city government as a reporter and editor of the South Florida Newspaper Network prior to being elected to the Delray Beach City Commission in March 2000. He co-chaired the city's Downtown Master Plan Steering and Implementation Committees, and Old School Square in Delray Beach honored Jeff for his community service and support of historic preservation by presenting him with the Buster Musgrave Award. He is former president, founder, and publisher of the Education Times, a monthly newspaper covering local education news and issues, and he served on the boards of the Palm Beach County World Class Schools and the Delray Beach Education Foundation. Last year, Jeff was a finalist in the World Mayor Competition. Mayor, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Pleasure to be here, Carol.
Not too many years ago, your main street, Atlantic Avenue, was seriously struggling, and now it's full of life with all the storefronts occupied, the sidewalks crowded with restaurant seating. What happened?
Well, it's amazing, really, because it truly happened over a 15-year period, but really accelerated over the last 5 years. There was a point in time where the saying was you could roll a bowling ball down Atlantic Avenue after five and not hit anything. What happened was we went after the residential as a catalyst, and that jump-started everything. Restaurants and boutiques followed the people, but it all started with the residential housing.
How did you get the residential housing?
We did some unique things through zoning incentives at the time. We set up a performance standards and put those in place, and we were fortunate that the real estate market turned around, and there seemed to be a trend nationally of people wanting to come back downtown. we were ready for that. And when that trend hit, we had everything in place, as well as having a historic downtown. So it just sort of took off very, very quickly once the market was ready for what we had already put into place.
Sometimes it's very hard to marry new development with, as you say, your historic core. How did you do that?
Well, what we've done is we've set up design guidelines because we're very conscious here of trying to keep the charm. That's really kind of been our mantra. We see that as our franchise, so to speak, and as our brand. And so we're very sensitive in introducing new development that fits into the fabric that's already existing and looks like it belongs there. Now, it doesn't mean we're looking for cookie-cutter development. We allow creativity and some creativity in our design guidelines, but we want things that look like they belong, that enhance our charm and not detract from it.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep it from becoming too precious, too, you know, do you allow modern, contemporary?
We do allow some of that along the railroad corridor, which we never thought anybody would want to live next to train tracks. Now they've become some of our most popular lofts, live-work lofts projects and mixed-use projects. I think that the big challenge is trying to keep it from becoming too precious, and that is something that it's a constant work and it's a constant battle against complacency. One of the things we're experiencing now is this pressure that downtown is done, and it's time to look at other things. And I'm of the belief that your downtown is never done, and that you really run into a danger if you become complacent. And it doesn't mean that you can't do other things. I think you can do both. You can concentrate on neighborhoods, the outlying areas, as well as your central core. But downtown is the heart of the city, and you always have to be cognizant of what's happening there. We've been lucky in that we've been able to build around mom and pop shops and nice restaurants, and we have not had the chain stores move in, but it is something that we're concerned about.
You mentioned the railroad track that cuts across Delray Beach, and it has been something of a dividing line in the community in the past, hasn't it?
Well, not so much the railroad track, as we have a historic street called Swinton Avenue that has been a racial dividing line throughout the history of Delray. And we're working very hard right now to unify the community. We have a very diverse community, and we see that as our strength. So when we did a downtown master plan, one of the fundamental underlying philosophies of that plan was that our downtown will extend from the ocean all the way out to our interstate. In other words, we break down that dividing line, and it's still a work in progress, but I think having that officially said in a document was a groundbreaking decision for this community.
Has it created any backlash in a sense of, well, you're taking over my neighborhood?
I think there's a constant concern about gentrification. So we have been trying to do some things to be sensitive to that. We're looking to create land trusts that will keep land affordable in perpetuity. We're trying to do as much as we can for affordable housing and for workforce housing. And I think we're winning that battle, but it is a fear in the neighborhoods that it'll be gentrified, and it's something that we're very aware of, and it's forced us to, and I actually think it's a healthy thing, to be in constant communication with our community and to work with them on strategies to keep neighborhoods intact.
How do you finance, how do you incentivize affordable housing?
What we've done is we've tried to use a carrot approach rather than just a stick, in that we're not really going with inclusionary zoning. We're really offering developers density bonuses, and we're saying that we will give you more density if you provide us more affordability. And they've seemed to have grasped onto that, and that allows for them to be creative, and it also gets us what we want from a public policy perspective. And with the design guidelines, we don't lose that feel either. And we're finding that developers can be very creative, along with architects, and give us well-designed projects with a degree of affordability. But it is a constant battle that we're fighting, because in South Florida we have a very hyper real estate market, and it's something that we're very concerned about.
You promote the city as a Village by the Sea and all the banners around say Village by the Sea. How did that theme develop?
That's been around for a long time. It used to be called the Ocean City, but it really just kind of fits what the city is when you first arrive. Just has a very laid back yet sophisticated feel. I know that sounds contradictory, but it's a relaxed atmosphere, but it's also very, very elegant. And I think it just has a village-like feel. Even though we've grown, we've kind of kept that small-town charm. It's still a place where if you walk down Atlantic Avenue or Main Street that you see your neighbors. It's a place where people still go to the local coffee shop to talk about the issues of the day. And we've managed to keep that despite the growth that we've experienced.
Is that the lens that you use to make decisions, test decisions at City Hall? I mean, will this enhance the character of Delray Beach as a Village by the Sea?
That's my lens, and we're very big on planning in Delray and in community inclusiveness and reaching out to the community and asking them what they want to see. So the plans that we have are really citizen-driven plans. So I will always refer to those as my touchstone when we make a decision on a particular development or a project that would come in, and that's the lens that I do look through. Will this enhance what we're about and trying to be, or will this detract from it? And that's really been a good touchstone for me as a policymaker.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Mayor Jeff Pearlman of Delray Beach, Florida. You are a journalist. That's your background. And I'm curious, when a journalist comes into public office, you must see the other side of things.
It's been difficult for me to be completely honest. I was not used to being on the other side of the microphone, and I also know how the job should be done. So my standards of what I've tried to hold our local press corps to, I think, has been probably higher than most people in my position. So I still see things as a journalist. I still see where the stories are, where the trends are, and I admittedly get frustrated when I don't see that end up in the paper the next day. I think there's so many compelling issues that are happening in Delray Beach and in South Florida that are relevant to people's lives that I'm not really seeing covered adequately in the daily press right now. So that's a constant issue with us and trying to get our message out. And, you know, as a journalist, it's been particularly frustrating for me.
And, of course, you're very aware of the debate going on around the country about the relevance of the daily newspaper and the speculation about how to improve circulation. You've chosen to communicate directly with your citizens through your online letter. Tell me about it and tell me why you started it.
I write a weekly column that I call Random Thoughts from the Mayor's Desk, and it's born out of my frustration of not being able to get the message across in a way that I thought was appropriate and relevant for what was happening in our city and what people need to know. And I've enjoyed it, and I get a huge amount of feedback from it. So it's been very important to me to do that. And we're trying to use the internet to reach people. But I'm also doing a lot of roundtable discussions. I have a monthly pizza and policy meeting where we gather people around just to hear what's on their mind, but also to present information that we think is relevant to their lives.
Do you buy the pizza?
I buy the pizza.
Sounds like a pretty good deal. Our colleague, Otis White, who's with us here every week on Smart City, has written about Delray Beach for Governing Magazine. In fact, he's written a couple of pieces. And there are a couple of things in those articles I want to ask you about. One, he talked about a responsibility revolution in Delray Beach, sort of turning the whole idea of citizens as the people who knock on the door of government and say, gimme, gimme, around to government and citizens being partners in working on the community. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that was a philosophy that was born out of community policing, where we recognized that the police department could be much more effective working in partnership with the community, that we could have that many more eyes and ears in regards to crime. And the mayor at the time put us on this track that we're still on today, which is extraordinary because you're talking about a 15-year period with election cycles, but we're essentially on the same track. And as a result, I think we've come further faster than many other cities because we have a continuity of leadership here and a continuity of that philosophy where we are not governing top down. We're taking the time, and it does take more time and a lot more effort to solicit opinions, to get input, to try to build consensus, but the payoff is that much better because you have that buy-in right away. So while it's tempting for us to sit up on the dais during commission meetings and dictate the way we think things should be, it doesn't work long term. You really need to bring the community along with you. So we've been very successful with that in engaging people and getting them to focus on community needs and building consensus and then putting those policies into place. And we find that politically and on the ground, it's a lot easier to accomplish what you want once you've done that work and once you've built that consensus.
All right, but here's a frustration that I sometimes experience. I'm busy. I'm going through my day. I don't have time to go down to City Hall and sit and make my opinions known. And all I go to the voting booth and I vote. And I vote with the person that I think is going to make good decisions. And sometimes it seems as if government can be taken over by the people who simply have a lot of time on their hands. Citizens who do have the patience and the time and the lifestyle to allow them to go to a lot of meetings and perhaps they're more outspoken than the average citizen. Do you ever feel like the process is, I mean, there's a twisting or an imbalance in the process of listening too much to a certain group of citizens?
I think that's an outstanding question. And one of the biggest challenges you have, and I think that the reason you're either successful or unsuccessful, is that you have to be able to differentiate between those people that are going to, for lack of a better word, hog the civic spotlight. And you have to drill deeper and to go out into neighborhoods or to solicit opinions from people that don't have the time, that also make your city work and are consumers of what the policies that you're creating. So it's very important as an elected official to not just rely on that front row that is there at every meeting and to recognize that there is a big city out there and you need to do whatever you can to hear what those people are saying, and if they're not saying it, call them up, and we do that, and go to where they are, and in different forums, safer forums than City Hall, where people are limited to a few minutes of time, and there's cameras in the room and notebooks. Create those safer forums where you can get some meaningful input, and that's what we've been doing now for about 15 years.
Delray Beach is in Palm Beach County, in an area of the country as dynamic as South Florida. How do you carve out your own identity and your own niche, particularly when it comes to the array of things that City Hall is responsible for?
Another great question, Carol. I think for Delray Beach, we always had this jewel in terms of we were blessed with this great grid system and a historic downtown that empties out into a beautiful ocean. And for us, it was a matter of recognizing that because I think we had lost sight of what that strength was. And I think communities need to take a look at what their unique strengths are and decide what that is and just see if they can polish it a little bit and market that and try not to be like everybody else and to try to differentiate. And that's particularly important, I think, in areas like South Florida where there is a lot of cookie-cutter development and a lot of tract housing and no sense of place. We've been very conscious about creating a sense of place. Placemaking is becoming more and more important. And now that we've done it downtown, we're going to look to do this in our more suburban areas and create a sense of massing and scale and linear parks and landscaping and design so that we can create a sense of place throughout the community. And I think that's really important.
Are the people moving to Delray Beach different than those who've lived there for a long time?
I think the city is in transition. I think we're beginning to attract what Richard Florida calls the creative class, people that are urban explorers, for lack of a better word, that don't necessarily want a big city lifestyle, but are very comfortable in a small to mid-sized city that has some sophistication and a lot of things to do, a healthy lifestyle, a pedestrian-oriented lifestyle, recreation, and culture. And we're beginning to recognize that and beginning to shape policies to recognize the new reality and who is moving here and making sure that this is something that they're going to be comfortable with. And I think there's tremendous economic development opportunities with the new group of people moving into the Delray Beach lifestyle.
You have very high-performing schools in your community. I know you've spent a lot of time working on schools and in education. What's the secret there?
The secret was we have a county school system, mm-hmm. so we do not exert any direct control over our schools. But we understood early on that the success of our community was very tightly linked to the success and reputation of our schools. We just could not attract young families into our city in the 80s because the schools did not have a good reputation and they were not performing. So what we did was we gathered the community and we came up with a blueprint for what we wanted our schools to look like and what programs we'd like them to offer. We had a huge amount of community support and business support, and we presented it to the school board. And that vision plan has really come true. And the city itself has spent close to $9 million on schools, which at times have been controversial because it's not our direct responsibility. But we've seen a huge return on investment in terms of providing schools that our kids deserve and need if they're going to succeed in the 21st century, raising property values, and now being able to attract young families because they're no longer afraid of our schools and we offer the programs that are attractive to parents and children.
I know that you have city officials from other communities traveling to Delray Beach to learn the lessons that you have to teach. Tell me the questions they ask and how you share those lessons.
We have a steady stream of visitors that come here, and we love to show them what we've done and to ask questions of them and answer their questions. They're seeking, I think, a sense of place. I think they're seeking some hints as to how do you jumpstart a downtown? What do you do to incentivize people to move back downtown? And we feel very privileged and a responsibility to share those successes and also learn from those communities that are coming in. I'm in the midst, Carol, of creating a nonprofit institute that I call the Delray Beach Institute. That's going to be celebrating community innovation and civic entrepreneurship and sort of sharing that story of how far we've come and some of the principles that we've learned. And I'd like for Delray Beach to be a national center for small and mid-sized cities, a place where people can gather in a safe environment and talk about the issues and challenges and opportunities that face cities of our size and demographics. And we're very excited about that, and we think that we have kind of come of age and we're at a point where we have a responsibility to share what we have done over the past 20 years.
Mayor, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Jeff Perlman is mayor of Delray Beach, Florida. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith spends a lot of time running. It's good exercise, but it also gives a good barometer of how helpful people are.
Whenever I'm out running, there's a pretty good chance that somebody is going to stop and ask me if I'm okay. This is no surprise, I guess, since the expression on my face is a dead giveaway for the agony in my lungs and legs. But it's just pain, not real trouble. Usually, people come up after I'm stopped and am standing there bent over grabbing my shorts and dripping sweat and drool onto the ground. People in cars stop to lean out their windows and ask if they can do anything for me. Once, on a 90-degree day, I stopped running at the bottom of a steep hill that I just couldn't face after 40 minutes in that heat already. So I stood there staring at the ground, gasping for air, as a car drove by on the other side of the road, made a U-turn, and then pulled into the restaurant driveway behind me. The driver asked if I was okay. I stood up straight like I always do and used a deep, bold voice to assure him that, yes, I was perfectly fine. Well, he told me, he had asthma, and sometimes when running his chest would tighten up only to discover that he'd forgotten to bring his inhaler with him. He said I had that same posture, which made him concerned that perhaps I was having an asthma attack. And if I was, he was going to give me a ride home or to the emergency room. I was speechless. Here was a person concerned not only about my comfort, but also proactively worried and thinking about my welfare. I thanked him for his thoughtfulness and then walked up that hill, sure that I had met one guy in a thousand. A graduate school professor of mine published an article years ago in Playboy about probabilities and decision-making. He told a story of seeing a woman with a flat tire on the highway. His wife wanted him to stop, but he didn't, explaining that based on the odds of someone stopping and the number of cars passing by each minute, it would be no more than 15 minutes before she got help. My professor's calculations were impeccable, but I've always been concerned about any logic that makes it okay for us to leave the welfare of others to chance. In fact, if we all decided to do nothing because odds are someone else will eventually do something, then nobody will do anything and no one will get any help. In fact, we don't want a society in which it's okay and customary to pass by others in need. Because one day that person is going to be you or me. Certainly, we don't want to waste scarce material and emotional resources on needless worry and aid, but neither do we want to abandon others to the vagaries of fortune. Instead, we want to be on the lookout for the posture of distress, ready and willing to make a U-turn to help. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.